going to have a hard time moving public pollutants.
Public, no, you'll have it. They'll stay there. But they, I can't afford it. I know that sounds so. Nobody wants to come here. Come, let's go.
It was like Chief of State when I went.
Yeah.
You know, I love the loneliness, isolation.
I did too. I was just down there this weekend.
Really?
I saw the town of Paradise. It's just it. I couldn't believe it. What happened in that town?
Yeah. Gone.
Gone. It is. It is like Vancouver. There's nothing on my parents' house. Everybody's house is gone. But the town is just like this. Like, I mean, nothing.
I'll bet you only about 30% of the people had insurance.
$52 billion, these are rough numbers, $52 billion in damages, $26 billion in insurance.
So, I guarantee you, BG&E will pull the pin and go bankrupt. That's the whole point.
That's not why that power. That's that.
Getting our container in Antioch.
Yeah.
Big mill I used to service. And they put a deal together, Cogen, brand new Cogen plant.
Yeah.
And after about 2 years, the check stopped coming. So Gaylord turned them off. Eugene took the court and said, you can't do that. The judge agreed. You got to, even if you're getting paid, you got to give them power.
Less than so it's traveling. One football field.
Preheating, huh?
Couldn't. It's not PG's fault. I mean, the fire may ignite it.
I think we are about ready to get started. So, good evening, Planning Commission members. Before we start, I just want to quickly inform the PC that here comes Mr. Swindle. Good timing. The council, after their interview, appointed Rick Torres as a new Planning Commission member. I know we have two items tonight on the agenda for this work session, so by introducing him, I would like the chair to also welcome him and then have each one of you introduce yourself. If Rick wants to give you some background about himself, he can do so, but let's take this opportunity to welcome him. I turn it over to the chair. Thank you.
All right, well, hi, good evening. Welcome to your first Planning Commission work session. I'm Steve Marash, current chair. I will be here for the first part of the work session, and then when we move to item number two, I'm going to be stepping out.
Saw that.
I think you were on the email.
Yep.
So, welcome.
Thank
anything
you.
You'd like to say? Or
no, happy to be here.
Happy to be here.
Yep. Looking forward to signing 4 years.
All right. Carl Johnson, the center. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Enjoy all the people I've met here. It's good people.
Rich Bender in East Vancouver, 4th District. I'm approaching my third year now.
Okay.
Robin Grimway from the Battleground area. And this is my second year.
Seems like one of them.
Yeah.
Ron Barca. I guess I'm still acting vice chair. Been on this commission for 19 years.
Okay.
Wow, 19 years?
19 years?
Sounds good.
Matt Swindell.
Thank you, Matt.
That's good. Ridgefield.
Okay.
So I think it was my second year.
Okay. Yeah, I live in Ridgefield. I've been in Clark County about 20 years. Been in Ridgefield for 3 years. Prior to that, I lived in the Flyda area. Since I moved here, worked for Vancouver Police Department from 1999 until 2006, and then for the Clark County Sheriff's Office until 2 years ago. I'm now a business development manager for Gaston Engineering Company, based out of Danbury, Connecticut, and I manage territory in the western states and have a home office.
All right. Well, hey, welcome to the Planning Commission.
Thank you.
All right, so our first item is the University District Code update. That's CPZ 2019-00026. We'll have a hearing on this item on February 21st. Introduce myself. I'm Lori Lebowski. I'm actually with Public Works. And I'll just have other people who will be part of this presentation tonight introduce themselves.
Ballinger, I'm the Vice Chancellor of Finance and Operations at Washington State University.
Go Cougs.
I'm Don Whitty, Forgery of BAM. We're assisting the university and the master plan process.
So tonight, what we're going to go over in the work session is just give you the background on both the University District Code and WSU's master plan. I'm going to present the proposed change to the University Code that's in your binders. Why are we making this change? Why are we doing it now? We'll have a brief discussion of the open houses that were held last year for WSU Vancouver's master plan update. And then I will go over the timeline to complete this project. Next slide. So for some of the newer members, just a brief history about WSU Vancouver. In 1989, WSU Vancouver was located on the Clark College campus. Washington State established branch campuses in Spokane and the Tri-Cities as well in 1989. The original master plan for WSU Vancouver was prepared in 1992. In 1994, WSU and Clark County collaborated on the establishment of the University District. The University Zoning District, and the University Zone was established and adopted in 1995. The completion of the original building at WSU Vancouver was in 2006, and then the undergraduate building was completed in 2009, which increased the undergraduate, freshman, and sophomore populations on the campus. The second campus master plan for WSU Vancouver, that update occurred in 2007, and with that update, graduate and faculty housing was permitted. So a little bit, just briefly about this docket item. If you look in your binders, tab 2, you'll see there's the staff report, and then there's the attachment to the staff report. If you can look at page 4 of the attachment.
That's Exhibit 1?
Yes. That's the change. That's the only change to the University District, the development code. All we're doing is adding to the use table on page 4, we're adding dormitories as a use permitted outright. So that is it. That's what we're talking about for you making a recommendation to the county council. So next slide.
So is there a definition in county code of dormitory?
There is not. I consulted with the community development and they believe that we didn't need a specific definition of dormitories.
Is there any limit on density, minimum or maximum on a dormitory, or how's the code define that?
Well, you go through a site plan review for each dormitory, but there's not a density target. Typically, I believe you build that many dorms where you have to have a density maximum or minimum. So let's see, slide 3. These are the components of the master plan update for WSU Vancouver this year. We're talking about 3 new academic buildings, a student union building, and then the undergraduate dormitories. So before WSU Vancouver can update their master plan, we have to update the Title 40 Development Code to allow dormitories as a use permitted outright in Title 40. So this is just step 1 in the process for WSU Vancouver. I'm going to now turn it over to Lynn to talk about, say a few words about the master plan update.
So as part of my role, just to give you some background, I started at WC Vancouver as a graduate student. I'm one of those people who wouldn't be living here except for the fact that WC Vancouver had a graduate program, otherwise we would have chosen to live in Portland. So I've been embedded in the university from a variety of perspectives. I started working for the university after we moved from the Clark College campus to the campus that we're on, and I was originally the facilities manager, and I assumed the current position in 1999. So I've been a part of the place for an awfully long time. In 2006, we added freshmen. It was very quick and somewhat anticipated. During that time, we were under the development of our master plan update, and we already had almost a year of public outreach. So rather than at that time try to change anything, we just continued as we were. But we understood that the addition of freshmen or of undergraduates at some point would likely result in a demand for student housing. That's the number one question our chancellor gets when he welcomes all the new students and their parents every year. The first thing they say is, where can my students find housing? And 95% of our students are from Clark County high schools, so it's not that they're out of state. We put 5 children through college, and we love them dearly, and we would like them close, but not necessarily in our home, and that's a sentiment expressed by many of our parents. So the other thing about housing is that students who have a residential experience on average have higher retention and graduation rates. And it's because if you're a student, the more you have to do that revolves around your student identity, the more likely you are to stay being a student. When you have a job elsewhere and you're living elsewhere and you have family elsewhere, it's just we don't see as high of retention as an industry for people who are non-residential. So the idea that residential would also solve problems for our students are not wealthy students. Half of our students or more than half of our students get federal grants, Pell grants, which indicate a level of poverty. 3/4 of our students have some form of financial aid. But some of our students don't have a safe place to live. And so also university housing provides that traditional bridge from living in a family member's home, your parents' home, to living on your own. There's kind of that middle of the road, as it were. So those are some of the reasons why we started looking at housing. I also want to stress that we don't have a project. We have not done, we did a feasibility study back in 2007, I think, but we don't have a project, we don't have bids out, we don't have anything designed. So this is just conceptual in nature. It's not like the minute something changes, we're going to be, you know, ready to go at the scene. So I also thought that might be interesting.
So. With the master plan update, WSU Vancouver held open 3 open houses last year, and I'm going to turn it over to Don Hardy to talk a little bit about the open houses and the process and comments you received.
Thank you, Laura. Zimmer Gunzel Frasco is an architecture firm that actually led the master plan process. Berger Rabem, our company, is assisting in that process. I just wanted to point out the architecture part of this in terms of laying out the master plan started out with 3 open houses to basically get public input on the process for the open house for the university undergraduate housing. First one was basically to get general sentiments of the community and the neighborhood. Mount Vista and Fairgrounds Neighborhood Associations were notified of these open houses. They were fairly well attended. Most of the sentiments around this were more about location of university housing versus not wanting university housing. Although there were some comments, you know, that related to people not wanting dormitories at all. To Steve's question, I wanted us to point out the master plan process. The master plan is the next step in this process. That's before anything happens on the campus. And that would set the amount of dormitories on the campus, the master planning process itself. So the zoning is not, because it's not the definitional issue about, it's basically a definition of the type of activity that's going to happen there, but the master plan would set the numbers of dormitories on the campus. That's site plan review would be subsequent to that. In the outreach process, in addition to Patty Tiller, Zimmer Pencil Frosta, and you can talk more about the outreach process. I'll just kind of segue for Patty to speak. There were a number of Columbian articles on this update as well. There were three articles in Columbian at the same time. It's fairly well publicized to get the community input on the master plan update process. Just a little context here in terms of the items that we have, the three bullet points. Essentially, the only really additions to the campus are student union and the undergraduate housing. Everything else on the campus was already approved in 2007 through that master planning process, which included a full traffic study and analysis, which would include these undergraduate housing units. There's been extensive review by WSU. 2007, there's an environmental impact statement to go through and evaluate traffic issues. Parking has been evaluated as well. It's part of the master plan process. Just wanted to leave with that. The parking is part of an ongoing monitoring program. And through that process, through a site plan review, it's being monitored. And there's a ratio that's set up. And that's something that will continue to be monitored for WSU. There's not an inadequate amount of parking on the campus that will remain the same in the future. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Patty to talk a little bit more about outreach. I started out talking about Patty. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the architecture pieces of starting out the open houses.
Yes.
What came out of that?
Very well. Well, before we get to the open houses, there was a lot of publicity about them. We wanted to be sure everyone knew about them. There was an outreach to the Neighborhood Association, which is very active. There were investments in the Columbia. I think that the estimate is that it reached about 55,000 people. There was outreach also through the university's own flowers, digital flowers. And we don't know how many that is, but it adds up over time, Twitter and the other social media. So it was very extensive. There was not a direct postal outreach this time, because in the past we had heard that that was not very satisfactory. It was sent to everybody, but people said they didn't necessarily get it. However, of course, there was notice to everyone within 400 feet of the property in any case. So we think that we covered about 90-something percent of the possible people who'd be interested in it.
Adam, I want to point out that for this process, for this docket item for University District Update, we did send out notice of the Planning Commission hearing to all property owners within 300 feet of WSU Vancouver. So specific property owners did receive notice of the Planning Commission hearing coming up. And we do have a web page for the University District Update, and that was included in the mailer that went to the property owners.
Thank you. There were three open houses. The first one really was sort of open book. It said, well, here's where we've been from the original master plan 92. Here's how the university has grown. Here's where we are today. And here are the things we're thinking about. What do we need to be careful about? What do we need to think about in particular? So it was really an open invitation to comment. And then having had that, we went forward and we went through a series of different concepts as to where housing might go, where the student union might go, to meet the various things that we had heard. Came up with a concept which put the dormitories far away from the neighbors, in close proximity to the facilities and the campus core, which the students would be expected to want to use. We went out again the second time saying, well, here are the options we've looked at. Here's where we think it's going, what do you think? And then on the basis of the input we got from that second open house, we finalized the plan, and before coming to the county, took it for a third time and said, here it is, any last thoughts before we move forward. So that really was the process that we went through. It's fairly comprehensive, I would say.
Thank you. Let's see the slide. So just to reiterate, right now We're just looking at updating the University District Zoning Code. There's only one location right now in Clark County where it applies, and that's WSU Vancouver campus. It's not, I mean, it could apply to other places. For example, if Clark College wanted to locate somewhere in the urban unincorporated area, that zoning district could be applied there. As I mentioned, we have to update the zoning code before WSU Vancouver can go on with their master plan update. So there's several steps that have to happen. For the master plan update, the university will have to go through a type 3 hearings examiner hearing, so another round of public review. And then, as Don mentioned, if they wanted to build a dorm, they would have to also go through site plan review, and that would be site plan review for each building that would be constructed. Next slide. And just to finish, this is our public process. We took this item to DEEB, Development Engineering Advisory Board, on January 3rd and went over the proposed code changes with them. They recommended unanimously to have them have that change approved, and we're going to County Council on March 19th. So we've got our hearing in 2 weeks, and that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to take any questions that you have. One other thing, because this is a change only to the Title 40 Development Code, it's not changing the plan, so we can do it at any time. It's not restricted to just once a year. So should the council adopt the code changes, once we have the adopting ordinance passed, the code change would go into effect 15 days after the adopting ordinance is approved. Any questions?
I have it's more a comment, maybe a question, just to make sure I understand, make sure we're all on the same page, because I know there's been some public comment on the dorm issue, and to the extent any of the members of the public are here tonight or listening to the tape. As I understand the proposal, we're allowing dormitories, if this is approved, would be an allowed use. As far as the number of units or density, that would be established through the master plan, which is a type 3 public hearing application, but it would go to the hearings examiner. It would not come to the planning commission.
That's correct.
And the criteria include criteria 4B, provide land uses and intensities that are consistent with the comp plan in this chapter and with planned capacities of public facilities. So they have to show through that process that they've got adequate public facilities to serve the number of density of dorm units. And also criteria E, do not significantly adversely impact the surrounding properties and uses. So those would be two things that would be looked at by the hearings examiner in a public hearing, but would not be addressed by this planning commission.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You said that you didn't have a general idea of the density, but I'm looking at your master plan and it says that it's anticipated that up to 300 undergraduate beds will be built.
And just to clarify, I didn't really talk about the number, but I can dive into that yeah. detail.
Just for a general idea.
Yeah. There's two buildings, and those are shown in blue in the master plan. And so just to be clear, those are both labeled W. And the master plan, I believe, identifies those both as having up to the potential of 300 units apiece.
How many did you say? 200?
300.
300 piece, a piece. Okay.
And then just for clarification, there's also O, you see graduate student faculty housing under O at Zebra-striped.
Can't tell your O's from your Q's.
It's kind of hard to see, I know. So I apologize.
Is that next to the A?
Yeah, next to the A.
Okay,
and
right.
So there were about 25 graduate faculty housing units that were approved in 2007. There'd be about another 275 units undergraduate in that same building.
Okay.
So there'll be 275 there and 300 in the other two is what's shown in that plan.
That's a general though.
That's a general ballpark.
That's what I was trying to get without pinning you down.
So.
Has that question been asked a lot? How many? By the public?
Somewhat.
The answer is we don't know, because the state of Washington isn't going to fund the dormitories. It's going to have to be a public-private, most likely, or some other avenue. And so there has to be a market study. There has to be a demand study. So it's unclear. The research that I have shows that buildings tend to be viable around 300 beds, and so that's our kind of general planning direction. But we don't have the studies that say exactly what's necessary.
Cool, thank you.
So to build on what Steve brought up, the way that this is going to come down, the people who have the biggest concern are not going to get really an opportunity for the hearing of the details of the plan.
That will be during the master plan update, and that will be a hearings officer, and that's a public hearing, and they can provide testimony.
Yeah.
As well as, I mean, in this process, but in terms of the issues that we are talking about, that's not what this item is regarding.
But the public will come forward expecting the university to be transparent on this and to divulge what their plans are to the best extent possible. Telling them that it's not really decided yet and we're still kind of thinking about it and it's going to be funded in a fashion that we're not quite sure of, doesn't really give the surrounding community the confidence that you're being transparent as we are expecting this process to be. And it happens to us all the time where people are wanting the details, but we say, well, all we're doing is putting a line on the road, or all we're doing is changing the zoning. How it fills itself out isn't the board's or the planning commission's hearing, and it leaves people with a situation of them believing like this is being pushed forward without them being able to understand whether they should be on board with it or they should be opposed to it. And so what I'm going to ask you to do is spend a little bit of time, and when you come to our hearing, give us a presentation of some substance in the realm that is able to be able to explain the general thought process. Parking and density are a big deal. Tell us how you're going to handle that, other than the fact that it's going to be covered. Parking's going to be covered, don't worry about it. Nobody can take that in and feel like they're getting a reasonable presentation of what their future is going to look like. And I don't think we're very far away, really, from what you're saying, but we don't have anything that goes up on a screen. We don't have anything that we can really be able to say this is the best of the intention right now.
Well, we do have specific parking. I believe that's part of the master plan rather than the planning commission, so I'll defer to whoever makes the rules around here.
If I may, the planning commissioner, Becca, you're absolutely correct, but I think that it's very similar to when we say, okay, this area is planned for single family, R16, that's what you're permitting. Yeah, when someone comes in, look at their property, see whether they will get up to that minimum or maximum density that we allow. That's typically how it is done. In this particular case, what the Planning Commission is allowing is in a university district, which is what this area is now designated, should dormitory or student housing be permitted? That's what is before you. Now, when that is approved under the university district, the next phase is the discussion about the master planning, the orientation of the building and parking and number of units. We did not put number of units in the university district. Some of you that went to university will see six-story building, apartment, or housing. That is going to be dependent on how many number of, freshmen are you admitting. Would you require them to live on campus? And how would that be rotating over time as they graduate? Those type of issues, while it's difficult at this point, will be addressed at the time of when the master plan and the funding and, you know, the character, the public will still have the opportunity to weigh in through the hearing examiner's opportunity. I think that's how this will occur. Very similar when we say, okay, this area is going to be designated as commercial, we're going to release the type of uses that will be permitted. We don't typically say, okay, it's going to be Safeway, tell us how you're going to design that and how many parking lots. Until when they submit an application, that's when we begin to review that and say, okay, the concern now is how are you going to address parking issues, for example? I don't know. But the university will be a good neighbor and address that when they have a site plan and what is it that they're going to do. That's how I would address that.
Of course I would. I mean, that's the way it always is. But it isn't anything but the minimum. What I'm advocating for is an opportunity to give them a little bit more than the minimum. Because I believe a lot of these things are already known. We just didn't put it into the presentation because it wasn't germane to the specifics of will we allow dormitories, yes or no.
So
that's what we're gonna vote on, but we leave a lot of people with a bad taste in their mouth when all that happens is we say, oh, go for the dormitories. And they say, well, what's the details? If you have regulations that the university uses at their other sites, and you're going to be using those as a generalized basis, they're already known. If you already have in your master plan how you're handling your parking, then it's already known. And it isn't anything more than giving the public the opportunity to hear more than the minimum.
So to your point, because clearly the public are looking for the detail's not ready yet because we're still in a conceptual planning phase, what about a roadmap that says, you know, this is sort of the first area we're looking at, this is the second area, and in the second area, this is where we will address parking and these other issues of concern. And that can just be one slide in the presentation, perhaps. The other thing from the public comment I've read and heard, has the university got a neighbourhood agreement so that there is some sort of formal mechanism of consultation going forward for the university on a myriad of issues so that the community feel that there is a formal mechanism which they can tap, express their views in the years to come? And that may be highly beneficial for being the good neighbour because it gives the community a feel that there is a formal mechanism. They have an opportunity to work directly with the university and resolve issues through that, to bring them into the parking issue and actually get them to start owning some of that responsibility for how do we improve parking collectively. Because you can only do what's permissible within your own property, but working with the community might be able to help come up with a better solution for you, which is more cost effective.
So just last year, WSU Vancouver did have 3 open houses. That's part of their master plan update. And I'm happy to add a slide to talk about the process, about this docket item. And then the next step for WSU Vancouver with the master plan update, and then when the funding's available and when they plan to go ahead, that they go through site plan review. Happy to do that.
I don't think there's any problem in constantly reinforcing it because this is like a change. And until you get people saying, for goodness sake, stop telling us, we are happy, keep reinforcing a constant message going forward. So as long as you keep telling them, this is where you have the opportunity for this, this is where you have the opportunity for that, and just keep pushing it out and pushing it out until they tell you to shut up.
I think a slide on process might be helpful, and if it included at least a reference to some of the criteria, like adequate public facilities and no significant adverse impacts to surrounding property owners, and the fact that the hearings officer will have to make findings under both of those criteria in the master plan process in a public hearing, that might help both maybe some calm some fears and also give people a roadmap of, you know, where do they go for the next step if they want to make sure that they stay involved, you know, as the process moves to the next phase.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, taking we'll add a slide to that effect. There's still a lot of unknowns, but we'll do our best to add a slide to address those issues in terms of path forward. And, you know, parking issues have always been, if I may editorize, it does have always been an issue around universities. It's not new, but when I talk about good neighbor, having worked at up at the hill, at the university, it is a tough issue to deal with. And it's up to the university to, you know, continuously be in a dialogue with the neighborhood on how to deal with those issues. In this case, right now, what they have is, in some cases, you have students that commute and they may decide to park in, you know, available state if they don't want to pay to park on the campus. That's going to continue to be an issue that the university will continue to address. But having experience and done facilities planning for universities, it is often difficult when you don't know what you're building. And again, my experience has been that some universities require freshmen to live on campus. That depends on the number of freshmen you are getting and the capacity that you have. Sometimes your parking, you deal with it internally within your campus. So that's something that they're going to, the university, I can't speak for them, but that's the dialogue that will continue. When they know exactly what they build and how many units they're providing, they will make a decision as to whether the parking requirement will be internal and how to deal with that issue going forward. But we will provide you a slide to outline the next process.
All right, sounds good.
I should probably just disclose my daughter will be there in a year and a half. That might be a conflict of interest. And can you hear from your bill?
That would be the note.
Just teasing.
My wind day, full man, no conflict of interest.
As long as it's not University of Washington.
I do want to say really quickly that I believe that WSUV is the jewel, and I graduated from there, so I'm a little biased, but it's a jewel. It's a jewel, and you had a powerful statement at the beginning, and what you did was more than just, it's a great place. You connected it to facts. If students are on that campus, they have a better chance of graduating. And as a school teacher right now, that message is always something we try to do. So I would encourage you to either repeat it, or because it was like, I never put the two together. I just thought,
it's what compelled me to support.
Yeah, so that's a powerful statement. So, man, we'll just throw that out.
Very good point.
That's
a good point.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. With that, I will step out of the room for the next agenda item.
That's it, Steve.
And I'll see you all in a couple of weeks.
Good, Steve.
See you next year.
I'm sorry again for being so.
Good to meet you.
You too, thank you.
Now I can have a chair.
Now, you went and got four. Like,
we have to have four now.
They said that you were
going to
miss
them.
Good to see you.
Yeah, the public is
fresh back.
Got
a sense of cutting yesterday.
Trust me, don't.
Okay, so it's great to see you.
Unfortunately, it'd be benign to take. They're going to take the brunt.
That's a good one. Because they haven't.
Yeah, they're stepping into the arenas. They're primed.
So, for some of the planning commissioners that were around in 2018, the first half of this presentation is going to be a revision of what you heard previously. For Commissioner Torres, I'm going to provide you some background as to what got us to the point we are today. So, again, this is the agenda that I aim to cover. This agenda item was originally scheduled in front of you on November 15th, 2018. At that time, you approved continuing the meeting, the hearing, until February 21st, and that would allow us to do some financial analysis for this. So to begin, urban holding is a tool that's used to phase development. In this specific area, we applied urban holding in 2007 when the land was brought into the urban growth area. The urban holding has two components, a zoning overlay as well as comprehensive plan overlay. The zoning overlay applies the detailed uses and intensities that are allowed in the zone, whereas the comprehensive plan designation overlay requires the amendment or removal of the urban holding to go through the Type 4 process, of which you're intimately involved in. That applies to the Vancouver urban growth area. For smaller cities, there's urban holding, but that urban holding is only lifted when annexation occurs. So in 2018, you reviewed phase one. This was the Killian Three Creeks proposal. This proposal was 40 acres, involved single family and multifamily development. And if you remember, this was accompanied with a development agreement of which they transferred TRIPS from their previously approved development agreement to this new one that went along with the removal to the urban holding ordinance. The proposal that is in front of you now and will be on February 21st is a proposal for 143 acres to be removed from the two overlays, the account plan plan overlay as well as the zoning overlay. The proposal is near the intersection of 50th Avenue and 179th Street. Some of the land is south 179th, but a majority of that land is to the north. It is primarily and is only zoned R175, so residential zoning. The proposal comes with a master plan for the development of what is called the Mill Creek planned unit development. There's a couple of terms that you'll hear with this proposal, and it can get confusing, but I want to make sure that they're synonymous with each other. Holt Homes is the applicant. Mill Creek PUD is the proposed planned unit development. Sometimes I may refer to it as Holt Homes, but it also means the Mill Creek PUD. The master plan is for 606 single family dwelling units as well as 99 townhomes. Those result in a total trip generation of 657 trips during the PM hour. When we talk about PMRR, layman's terms, it's rush hour. As part of the development agreement that goes along with this proposal, the applicant will financially contribute to these projects. These projects are in our capital facilities plan. Our capital facilities plan is our 20-year plan that outlines the necessary projects to accommodate the growth that's expected from development. So the development agreement has financial contributions that are built into the development agreement. The I-5 179th interchange replacement, it also includes these specific improvements. As you know, the I-5 179th interchange replacement is a planned project by the Washington Department of Transportation. It was allocated $50 million in 2016, and the state is currently going through the process of defining a solution to that interchange. Another project that's involved that will be financially contributed to from the development is the I-5, the 179th Street from Delphel Road, which is where the Chevron station is, if you use it, to 15th Avenue. 15th Avenue currently has a three-legged intersection going to the south and then east and west. This will include the construction of a roundabout at 179th and 15th Avenue, and then widening between the interchange and throughout the whole section of the project there. Union Road, which is where Jolly's was, will be terminated, and that traffic where that access will go south to a road that connects eventually to 15th Avenue. 15th Avenue. 15th Avenue, as I mentioned, is a three-legged intersection. Ultimately, the design and the project that's planned in the capital facilities plan is to extend 15th Avenue from 179th over to 10th Avenue. So, as you know, it's kind of a sweeping curve in order to connect it from 179th and 15th Avenue to 10th. This is specific mitigation that will be required that's very close to the actual development at 50th Avenue and 179th. It includes an installation of new roadway approaches to 50th Avenue and 179th, as well as a left turn lane at each of the access locations to the site. The provision of northbound left turn lanes at 50th Avenue intersection will be required with the site development at 50th Avenue frontage. So if you're on 179th and you're turning left onto 50th Avenue, it will be a left turn lane at the site at that location. So Urban Holding, the requirements and criteria that are specifically applied to lifting Urban Holding or removing Urban Holding is that it must be consistent with the Growth Management Act, must be consistent with the countywide planning policies, conformance with locational criteria, site suitability and lack of appropriate design alternative sites. It responds to substantial changes that better implements the comprehensive plan policies, as well as the timeliness of public facilities and services. Specifically for Urban Holding in this area, the comprehensive plan has this defined statement. Completion of localized critical links and intersection improvements that are reasonably funded as shown on the six-year TIP, Traffic Transportation Improvement Program, or through a development agreement. That determination of reasonably funded through this proposal is through the development agreement avenue. So the proposal is to use a development agreement in order to reasonably fund the localized critical links intersection. As you know, phase one, the Three Creeks, was approved by a planning commission recommended approval. We have these other three applications that are currently in the county. The one that you're hearing now is the Old Holmes Mill Plain PUD, Mill Creek PUD, excuse me, hidden development, as well as the Wall property. So if you remember in November 15th, the Planning Commission continued this hearing to allow staff the necessary time to develop options for making the critical links and intersection improvements recently funded. In the meantime, there's been a couple things that have happened. Number one is on December 4th, 2018, the Clark County Council approved a 1% increase in the road fund levy and that increase of road fund levy was specifically directed to go to improvements in the area, as well as they created this 179th I-5 committee. This committee has two separate missions. One, it provides the county council with a recommendation that identifies a funding strategy for funding those necessary improvements that are required for Urban Holding to be removed. And number two, it creates a public-private partnership that addresses the funding shortfall that we're currently experiencing. The county directed this committee through a council work session in January. The committee has had one meeting so far. It is scheduled for three weekly meetings. Two weekly meetings throughout the month of February, and that will ultimately result in a recommendation to the county council. I am going to move forward through the separate different funding sources that we're projecting here. We're going to get deep into a financial analysis, and I will kind of go through what the committee is contemplating this time. So the county's road fund has been dwindling for the past 5 years. A lot of this is due to the cost of projects as well as the amount that we can serve. As well as fee waivers. Thank you, Chris. The current revenue that's identified for these necessary projects in the transportation improvement program are the road fund, traffic impact fees or TIFs, REIT, which is real estate excise taxes, as well as projected grants through the state and federal government. The road fund is restricted by state law as to what we can use it for. There's currently $8.8 million of road fund allocated in the current transportation improvement program for the projects. In these slides, we say pipeline projects. That's basically five projects that are necessary for the capacity in the 179th area that's tied to the urban overlay. The traffic impact fees, we're currently estimating $7.5 million in impact fees to be collected over that 6 years. And these traffic impact fees will only be used on those pipeline projects. Real estate excise taxes. So as documents get recorded, there's a tax that's associated with it. Those real estate excise taxes can be applied to transportation improvements. Currently, the bottom here, $13.75 million would be allocated for the pipeline projects. Grants, we're projecting $11 million in grants. And then we're looking at other options in order to fund the necessary projects. It includes additional road fund levy. Currently, we have budget capacity for 4.23% of road fund, but in the different options that you'll see forward, we not just apply the 4.23, but also the 3% option, the 2% option, and the 1% option. We're also looking at reducing our preservation program for 1 year only by $2 million in order to fund the necessary projects.
Stop.
Yeah.
Preservation for the entire county?
Correct. For the unincorporated Clark County.
Yeah.
Clarify that. Not the cities, it doesn't apply to us.
Right.
So the maximum bank capacity for the road fund that's currently available is 4.23%. In our scenarios, it only includes a 1% increase to the road fund levy for just 2019, not the future years. So because the council acted on the 1% levy on December 4th that you see here, that bank capacity has been dropped to 4.23%. So the four different options that we're showing, the TIP funding that is needed for the total projects is the $66 million that's necessary. We are currently showing $30 million in our current TIP. The additional funding that we're projecting and or proposing is $30 million. That includes the 4.2, that should be 4.23 estimate there. That ends up with a shortfall of $5.865 million for those projects. That's option A. Option B is a 3% road fund levy. And as you can see, what's going to change in all of these is that light blue, that this property tax, the road fund levy. 3.52, so you're contributing less amount, so that increases our shortfall to 8.617. Option C, this is the 2% increase in road fund levy. This increases the deficit to $10 million. So those are the three options that are available to the county right now. As I mentioned, the 1% increase was passed by council on December 4th, 2018, and this provided $2.6 million to the projects. So with what was currently approved, you can see the deficit is increased by $12 million. So what has essentially happened in these different scenarios is we've showed options that allow to take the bank capacity, which lowers the deficit, and then all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which is option D, the 1% that they've already approved, which then increases the deficit that we currently have.
So Matt, can you go back over the $30 million on the TIP funding? From your slide, somehow I didn't see a $30 million number come up.
Yeah, so what I talked about was the current $30 million comes from these sources here.
That's the roll-up of all of those?
Yeah. The road fund, traffic impact fees, REIT, and projected grants. They're also shown, in this slide here. The red, orange, dark green, and light green. So these are what are currently in the TIF. This is additional funding that we've projected or have presented to the council as options to use. So $30 million. And then the gap 30. No, those don't add up.
No. This is a little bit of a 30, give or take 30,000.
You just say 137,000.
That's what we're doing. That is, we just rounded it up. It's like 3.6, 3.7, or whatever.
But the slide specifically that showed TIP funding, I just want to be clear about whether it's the aggregate or there was the six-year money, the pipeline money. That was what we were calling the TIP before, and now we're calling it all of this.
So the TIP is these sources here that are currently approved in the current TIP, 2019 TIP. If the council selects the funding strategy in order to fund these projects, these here are the additional funding that is available to the future.
One is 2019 REIT money, and then we're going for 2020 money.
Yeah.
Assuming they take 3%. Assuming they take
this is the 3%.
3% back to us. Yeah. That's how to look at it.
So this is the current where we currently stand with the $12 million deficit. In your staff report, you'll see this number referenced. This is our current shortfall.
So is it? Go ahead. The funding strategy. All of the funding strategies show shortfall. What happens if the estimate was not correct in the first place?
We are, our estimates that Public Works has done are very conservative, and we're, and they have contingency funds built into the project.
So do you know what methodology they use to determine?
I believe it's a 30% contingency.
No, not the 30% contingency, the overall methodology for estimating. Because there's different methodologies by which one can estimate a project. So what was their methodology and the level of confidence that the $66 million is going to be adequate for the projects, and so they don't walk back in halfway through and say, guess what, 66 is now 76.
So because there's five different projects that are involved in this pipeline project, there's, let's see, three of them that are currently far along in the process that they have accurate numbers. That includes 179th from Delfeld to 15th Avenue, 15th Avenue from 179th to 10th Avenue, and the 10th Avenue construction from 149th to 149th. So those projects are approximately, I want to say, 30% design.
Okay, so there was a baseline estimate. There's now a 30% estimate for some of them. Projects can still go awry and add significant costs.
Yeah.
So given that, has a risk assessment been done of the overall funding strategy?
So that's where I talked about, in addition to the amount that of those projects that were, that have been estimated, there's an additional 30% that's added on to those projects.
So the contingency is for unforeseen construction
Or inflation.
And what happens if, say, the reliance, so the other one is, what happens if the reliance on grants doesn't materialize? What's the risk strategy behind that theory?
So, again, the grants here, you're seeing an 80%
Robin, if and commissioners, if you would like somebody from Public Works Finance to come in at the hearing, it might be, those might be the people that you would want to ask about the, you know, what happens if inflation soars, or if you don't get half the grants, or what your degree of confidence is in some of these other numbers.
Yeah, that'd be fine. My main concern is, depending on the methodology that people adopt, estimates can go askew very, very quickly.
Well,
so once we know that methodology and what level of scope confidence they have, then 66 may be a 95% safe figure, or it could be a 10% safe figure. And who wants to have a project going midstream and then suddenly say, oh, by the way, county, we now need bailing out for an extra 20 or 30 million.
Understood.
Yeah.
But I don't think that anybody here is the person to answer
so
that.
So if you can get that, or
we will ask them to attend good hearing for this type of questions.
Okay.
And I have other observations to make after Matt is done.
Yeah. So.
You had a question? Oh. So those different bank capacities that we talked about, the 4.23%, 3%, and the 2%, this are estimated costs for a median household in Clark County. The development agreements would contribute $6.8 million, contributed by these proposals. One that you see in front of you is the Holt Homes. So they're estimating a development contribution of $2.9 million. That would be in the form of advanced TIF payment. That preservation reduction that we talked about earlier will be a one-time expense out of the preservation program to the road fund to add capital for those pipeline projects. And that is required in order for them to make that decision, decision budget package would have to be approved in the spring. So we talked about the shortfall. In order to fund that shortfall, we're looking at bonding capacity in the county. In order to back that bonding capacity, the committee is assessing the use of development surcharges to be placed in the urban holding area. For option A, that 4.23 bank capacity, where we have a smaller shortfall, that development surcharge would be around $800 compared to, on the other side of the spectrum, what's currently approved with a shortfall deficit of $12 million, that development surcharge is around $1,500. So what this development surcharge would do, it would be the service payment for the bonds that would be placed in order to fully fund the projects. The development surcharge would be distributed in the urban holding area and would apply to new residential or job and jobs specifically in that area.
The entire urban holding area, and then as these projects completed, would we be looking at a continuation of that surcharge as other urban holding opened up?
So the urban holding would be for the entire area?
It would be just for this 179 area. Currently, the urban Vancouver urban growth boundary, this is the only urban left urban growth area, urban holding area. So there is none.
So this would lift 100% of it, and 100% of the development then would take this surcharge based on whatever option is picked up.
Yes. Option D has been picked, correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
so option D, but those additional funding sources that we identified, those haven't been officially approved by council.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Two questions. Developmental surcharge pays only the interest on the bond?
No, pays the principal.
Principal too? And what are the length of the bonds?
That asterisk that's right underneath the table, does that belong to one of these bullets?
Belongs to all.
It belongs to all of them.
Yep.
So I just got to throw out a comment. So right now the funding deficit is $12 million. Right now we have a 30% contingency fund built into everything, which is about $21 million. So we just hit our numbers. We're going to be okay.
That's all right. I was going the other way. With what
just throwing it out there. Just throwing it out there. I know, you know, everything happens.
We're
but
not there yet. Yeah,
we can't count on that, but
yes.
Let's just hit the numbers and we'll be good.
Yes.
Just had to say it. A little positive in the room. A little
positive. We're not there yet.
Never mind. Go ahead, Mike. So with that, what we are recommending for Planning Commission on February 21st, is a conditional approval. This conditional approval is based on the County Council adopting a formal finding that the critical links and intersection improvements needed to create transportation capacity sufficient to accommodate the trips generated by the proposal are reasonably funded. Because at the end of the day, this comes down to a budget decision, this makes the decision to lift urban holding a budget decision for the council. Along with that determination of reasonably funded, the county councilors would also have to approve the development agreement that's associated with this proposal. Currently in the development agreement that is in your packet, there's this specific clause, and I have to pick on, I guess, lawyers at this point, because this is one sentence. So I'm going to try to read this. In recognition of the need for the Board of County Councilors to make a formal finding declaring that the improvements needed to create transportation capacity sufficient to accommodate the trips generated by the master plan, including the critical links and intersection intersections are as provided for in the comprehensive plan are reasonably funded, and in recognition that the removal of the current urban holding overlay zone must also occur before development of the property may occur, and recognizing that at the time this matter comes before the county councilors, the final funding package for the critical links and intersection improvements may not yet be adopted. The parties agree that the urban holding designation for the property shall immediately occur upon, but no sooner than, the Board of County Councilors' declaration that the improvements needed to create the transportation capacity sufficient to accommodate the trips generated by the master plan, including the critical links and intersections as provided in the comprehensive plan, are reasonably funded for 6 years. So what this does is, not only does your conditional approval, if it's adopted by the Planning Commission, say that council decision is needed, but it's reiterated in the development agreement as well.
Okay, that's...
So the Planning Commission schedule, the last work session that you had on this was October 18th. That planning, that hearing of November 15th, as I mentioned before, was continued to the 21st, the work session that we're at today. Today's date is February 7th. I'm sure there's a question.
Yeah, before you get into your questions, Planning Commission members, if I may, the 179 I-5 corridor, some of you that have been here a long time, the area was designated with an X going back to the 94 road plan, if you will. This area was brought into the UGB in 2004, 2007, also considered or part of the 2016 growth plan that was approved by the council. What I will add is that we have, when I say we, that means planning staff and the council, in some cases with members of the Planning Commission, we have been in a dialogue with the developing community on how to begin the conversation on how to lift up and hold in the 179 I-5 corridor. As Matt indicated, this is the only remaining urban holding area in the Vancouver UGA. So there's been a quiet conversation, if you will, on how to address the transportation deficiency in this area, because that's the only thing holding the area up for developing under the urban zoning. And as you can see from Matt's presentation, we pulled the hearing in November to give us some time to continue to have conversation with the council. We are at a point where the council have made it, taking the 1% last December, and we are still having conversation with the council. The conditional approval that we are recommending to you is also subject to the council making a decision or a finding that the localized liquid, critical links and the intersection improvement that we've identified that is necessary in terms of capital project for that area to leave, for us to leave the urban holding, they have to make a decision before anyone moved dirt. So I want to acknowledge the fact that we've been having this conversation with the development community for quite some time, and the fact that we are here, I would say that, you know, the county have made a concerted effort to get us to this point. And we'll be looking at the council to, with the committee that they formed to make a recommendation to the council that hopefully will meet the criteria for lifting up and holding. And that will have to happen before this matter comes up before the council. So just want to put that in perspective, that your recommendation is just conditional approval, subject to that finding by the council. As Matt indicated, it's going to be a budget call. You cannot take that bank capacity. It's not yours. It is the council that will be making that decision at some point in the future. So I want to leave that with you to, you know, think about. If you have questions, you know, we have our legal counsel here. We have Matt, myself, and we'll be able to answer your questions.
Thank you, Oliver. And I think based on that, though, this commission should think about what is the potential scenario that we are recommending go forward, and that looks like it could potentially be D. It might be A or B or C, but when we give conditional agreement to something that isn't crafted yet, but there's the four options, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that we're passing forward a recommendation for what could be the most severe or potentially the easiest to fund or the hardest to fund. So I don't think we can say right now that our conditional approval is anything but for worst case scenario.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those are the four potential choices.
You just said there's four potential choices.
Yeah, but passing forward this, saying figure it out, you're passing forward the option that it ends up being D, and it's $1,500 and some odd dollars in additional fee per unit.
And jobs.
Yeah, what about the jobs? Did I see some place where there was commercial land? I don't remember seeing commercial land in this presentation.
Well, for this proposal, it's all residential.
Right.
For the urban holding area, there's a mix of light industrial, commercial, mixed use, office residential, as well as residential.
Okay, and I think that's an important part of what we're really talking about, this for the grand scale of this development, because going back to the history of this, when we were looking at Discovery Corridor, we were this far with the Discovery Corridor, and this particular intersection was supposed to be a jobs-generating commercial hub, and somehow we brought it down to the idea of one phase of the project to go forward with, and it sounds like houses. And in your presentation, you present 900 to 1,000 houses?
This phase,
but that's in the presentation. Go back.
Yeah, there is Wollum and Hinton.
With all of them, it's about 1,000.
Yeah. You're right. But the total area, when we look at the total area, there is potential at build out of about 5,000 single family units. Similarly, the studies have been done, I'm only citing one, is also showing potential for about 5,000 potential jobs in the future. This is all built out. Immediately, remember that the Killiam property, which you didn't see, majority of the stuff to the south that Killiam owns is that it's not in urban holding, it's predominantly commercial. As you go north of 179 and along 10th Avenue heading to 319, it's all land for jobs on both sides.
But we don't emphasize that. And I guess this is my point, is it seems like we saw part of it right there, which sends one side of the story. But we're not, I don't think we're telling the full build-out story of this. And why is it so important for the public to take any risk on this at all? And I think that's an important part of us getting people behind and understanding we're going to extreme measures. We're asking the entire county to go without any kind of road repair for a year. And even though it's only $2 million, it's still the idea that this area has great potential for the entire county from an economic development standpoint as well.
No, you're right. You're right.
I do want to clarify something that you said. The road preservation is just a portion of the total annual budget. So it's not like we're putting the preservation crew on leave for a year. They're still doing their road preservation, but a portion of it, $2 million, is being moved. We're not going away from road preservation for 2019. Just $2 million of it.
Only $2 million would be taken.
Okay, so that's different than the way you worded it.
I apologize.
Let's just make sure the public hears it the right way. That's all I'm concerned about.
Do you have any
high level cost benefit type information where you could put a slide together and give a bigger context to the benefit to the county?
We can try, and again, get into Councillor Commissioner Baker's point. You know, this is one of those areas, if you look at it from economic development opportunities, which I cannot speak to tonight. However, this is one of the remaining interchange along the I-5 that really needs the investment to improve. That's why the state is putting $50 million to do the improvement of I-5 and 179. And there is opportunity there. Whether that will really be realized in the first 6 years, I cannot speak to that, but that opportunity is there. If the improvement, if the infrastructure improvement is made, that is all I can offer at this point. Those that have done the economic analysis, there was a study that Eric Hovey did that gave us the idea of potential for 5,000 new jobs and potential for 5,000, you know, residential, and what that would do. I don't know what, if all these projects are being done, what the economic impact is going to be for the county, but that is yet to be.
If you take a look in your binders in tab 4 after page 10 of Matt's staff report, you'll see a map that shows the whole urban holding area. And the phase 1, which was Killian North, which was approved in December, and phase 2, which is before you now, are darkened so you can see them. The Hinton property is south of 179th, and then the Woolham property is over to the west of I-5. So the vast majority of the urban holding area is not owned by these for developers, which is kind of, I mean, this area presents enormous problems for lifting urban holding and concurrency. If you have somebody who would like to develop their land, say, down in the southeast corner of the urban holding area, urban holding has to be lifted. For urban holding to be lifted, these projects along 179 and the interchange have to be taken care of. They have to be completed or reasonably funded. It's pretty tough for your basic mom and pop landowner slash developer to come up with the kind of money to fund 179. And that is part of why the county is working with these developers who have come to the county and asked to work in a public-private partnership to get this done and open up this area, including the residential and the other designations of land there. So it's a big deal. In terms of a cost-benefit analysis, I don't think that's a criterion. And so we generally don't do that. And I don't know who we would ask to do it. And I doubt that we have the money to hire a consultant to do it. You know, it might happen, but it's not a criterion.
It may not be a criterion, but I think in terms of painting a bigger vision of the significance of this development helps explain to the community why county funds need to be channeled in to do the foundations of the area.
You are correct.
And I think that goes a long way in sort of bringing people along. The only other concern I have is during this funding assessment that's gone on and the possibility of a bond and looking at the impact back onto the development, has any conversation been had with the developer as to what $1,700 or $500 extra may do to the marketability of their house lots in that area?
Yeah, that's been raised.
That house, and they're not...
Well, obviously it goes into the cost of the house. At some point, and depending on where the money comes from, what goes into the cost of the house might be more than this $1,500.
The developer's not worried about them, say, charging $350,000 for the same floor plan size house as, say, Data Killian for $200,000.
You know, whether they worry about that or not, I cannot tell you. That option has not been chosen. There are, by the way, other options. These are the four options that have been explored. But, you know, there are other possibilities, and the committee of approximately a million people in the last meeting requested that staff come and scope out what would be the ramifications of, instead of doing one of these, A, B, C, or D, adding the 1% every year, which is not one of the choices that's up there. So there are other possibilities. We don't know what they are. We don't know how the developers will react to them, because the developers, you know, they don't know what they are yet either. But at this point, they are all coming to the county and saying, we've got to lift urban holding as soon as possible.
Yeah, I hear that. But it's not unreasonable for a developer if you say, look, if the only way of getting this done was to possibly put a surcharge in the area, it's going to, you know, could be this, what do you do? They'll too soon tell you within split seconds whether they're willing to go the way or, hey, that's going to hold my way. They react very, very quickly. React very quickly.
Some of the developers are participating as part of this committee. They're fully aware of what's on the table and are participating.
So, all of their attorneys are.
Yeah, so there's been conversations with them, and there's no adverse reaction at this point in time.
None of them have pounded on the table and said, that's it, I'm leaving.
Okay, that's a good sign. That's a good sign.
As the attorney for the project.
Chair would indulge me, I'm Randy Prince. I like Ron, I actually got Oliver. I was around from the 1994 first comment, the county had it a lot. There's a couple of comments with it. This isn't just about a couple of developers who have come to the county in the last year and said, we need to have you look for a building. Yes. Number one, the comprehensive plan and the capital facilities plan to go with it, which this planning commission adopted, require transportation planning and require capital facilities plans to have planning and funding for the development based upon zoning that it is there. And so nobody is trying to change the zoning, and there is commercial property out there, there's residential property out there, there's mixed-use property out there. And for commercial, and Killian is a great example, this board body just approved transferring those trips that were commercial and jobs trips to residential to build houses. And the argument is, and I think it's well made, is that there is, until you get the rooftops out there, you're not going to have, you know, another new season, so you're not going to have office or whatever. So we have been at this with staff and the board since 2014 or 15. We have spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars on transportation analysis and economic analysis, and there is an economic analysis about this around that the county does have, and I will try to, I'll go find it, and we can put it into this record for you guys.
You're speaking of the OT analysis?
Yeah. And So what we have done, and so this started with, let's go try to get the interchange funded. So a lot of us were in Olympia, working with our legislators. It's 50 to 60 million bucks or more to do that. As you guys may or may not know, the way that state transportation and federal funding works, they don't just give you all the money at once. They give you some design money, and then they give you some of this, and they give you some. So we would
look at, in some cases, the county has provided
absolutely
the money for design and stuff.
Yes.
So
but the interchange, the big picture wasn't going to get fully funded until 25, 26, 27, and that depends on what the state legislature does and the state budget is. So we started looking collectively between the county and us. We're getting toward the end of the comp plan. This is the last area that, you know, that needs to get out of our holding and implement the comprehensive plan that you and the board adopted. So how do we do that? So we started working on funding alternatives, a whole bunch of transportation engineering alternatives, and came up with the transportation plan and the improvements that Matt walked you through and showed you. If we do these things, everybody agrees, all the transportation engineers agree, this would allow this area to develop if these projects could be recently funded. The bar that the law sets says you either construct them or they are reasonably funded within 6 years. Yeah. And if they aren't, or you can't make that finding, then you can't develop. So the plan that is before you is how to get to that number, which is now $66 million. And you see there, we are meeting every week now. Committee's getting close to recommendations based on all the financial analysis that the county has done. Some of them are there. The board may ultimately choose a different one. In terms of the development community's participation in this, we have right-of-way dedications. We've talked about advanced TIF payments. Most of us, I believe, are supportive of whether it was a higher TIF or a surcharge in order to fund this gap.
All I'm putting on the table is that, okay, there's a lot of work being done. There's a lot of benefit to come out of it. The project has risks. And are those risks adequately acknowledged and got mitigation strategies? Because civil engineering projects are known not to always come in on the budgets because of a whole lot of unforeseen things. We're at 30% design or less. There is a high probability, depending on how that estimating methodology was used, as to whether that could happen. And all I'm looking for is an answer that gives me comfort around that risk.
I'm not opposed to it.
Right.
I just want to make sure that people have addressed the risk.
But that's true for every public transportation, sewer, water project, public infrastructure project.
I know. I assess thousands and thousands of projects and look at project risk and prioritization. So I'm not.
Right.
So I think Robin and I are just trying to say that I think there's a lot more positive to this story that we're not telling with the way the presentation is.
Right.
Okay. And ultimately, I think as it goes on, we want to be able to say, you know, this is the part that unlocks the potential for this area. And we have to put the keys into this lock. And the keys are $66 million.
Well, I think that Matt has done a superb job of taking a very complex set of issues and numbers and making them reasonably understandable. And you're right, we didn't tell everything, but he did address the criteria. And there will be a public hearing at which I am sure that the proponents will come and speak forever about the benefits of this.
Probably not. Because I know that Steve has already had to recuse himself. That makes me the chair. So 3 minutes is plenty of time. I guess all that being said, though, we talked about the capital facilities plan. We didn't mention schools, but you put up 1,000 houses up here. What's the story with the Richfield School District?
So this proposal is in Battlegrounds.
Oh, is it? Okay, that's why. What's Battlegrounds' story?
Battlegrounds schools did not. We don't have a comment.
But it is in their CFP.
It's already in?
It's
their CFP?
Yeah. So with schools, what they do is when we go and we estimate the total number of houses or jobs that come out of an urban growth area, that number gets sent to the school districts. The school districts then build their capital facilities plan off of those numbers, off of our forecast of population growth number. So they plan on those schools in their budget, in their capital facilities plan that's adopted after the comprehensive plan gets adopted.
Which the last one is within Urban Hope.
I'm surprised they haven't targeted it.
It's the amount of population that's projected includes the development of the urban holding area.
I have a quick question, Matt, for my clarification. So, assuming funding is allocated for the infrastructure and the urban holding is removed, does it remove it just from the four project areas or from the whole area?
If it's identified, it will be for the whole area.
Okay.
And then it will come in phases.
Yeah, we're talking about do it all at once, do it in phases.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's one of the things that is yet to be determined, I think.
The financing scenarios are for 100% of the urban area.
Okay.
But when you vote, you're voting for something that's not determined yet.
And the underlying zonings will remain once it's removed?
Correct. Those do not change. The comprehensive plan designations do not change, and the zoning does not change. The overlays are removed.
Matt,
yeah.
There's no way that I meant to disparage your...
Ron, I don't think so.
Christine is like really close to the project. The public's going to come. They're not going to. And I think we can make this a strong, positive opportunity. I've been waiting for us to lift this urban holding for a long time. I know there's a lot of landowners that feel stuck. And we told them we were going to get to this, and I think we should really be trying to get to this, and it's in the best interest of the county. But we have to explain to them how we're going to be good fiscal managers. And so I think it's all in part of the package.
We'll put Rocky's Eye of the Tiger in the background as we move
forward in the presentation. That'll be strong.
Is that it?
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I guess we'll see you in 2 weeks. Is that right?
Come on. There's never going to be any deficit. We're going to have extra money at the end. Matt's going to be rolling around $100 bills because we have so much money left over.